you. So what I'm going to talk about is based on an ongoing project with Ira Rothstein from Carnegie Mellon. So we were visiting Caltech last spring, and we talked a lot about various problems in field theory, and you know, my favorite topic in physics is quantum field theory, and he told me there are many interesting things in as regards non-altruistic quantum field theory, that is, field theory without Lorentz invariance. And I could think, well, relativistic quantum field theory has been studied for 70 years, you know, and it's a huge subject, and field theories without Lorentz invariance include Lorentz invariant ones. Well, field theories which are not necessarily Lorentz invariant include Lorentz invariant ones, so it must be even bigger subject. Right? On the other hand, if you look at the concrete theories without Lorentz invariance, which occur in, like, you know, in applications, actually they're typically very boring from the point of view relativistic quantum field theories, in the sense that they don't really have any interesting UV divergences which lead to non-trivial renormalization group flow or anomalies or anything like that. So, so what are the field theories which are without Lorentz invariance which are interesting from the point of view of a person like me? Well, a cheap way to get field theory with UV divergences is to have an infinite Fermi C. So basically, when I have closed loops, you know, if you have normal non-altruistic propagator, then you won't never get any divergences because you don't have particles, no antiparticles. But if you want to get antiparticles, just, you know, any Fermi C seems like it will do. But if it's not infinitely deep, then you know, you can just say, well, it's just a different state in the field theory without the Fermi C, so you will never get any UV divergences anyway. So you need to have infinitely deep Fermi C, so to have interesting field theory. And what's an example? Well, the natural example comes from considering the following problem. So I have some, say, particle in a crystal, say electron, with some complicated dispersion law. And you can imagine that near some point, you can expand, you know, Taylor expand your dispersion law. And imagine you have some point where the linear terms vanish, so it's a singular point on the Fermi surface. And you have some dispersion law like that, plus high order terms. Lots of high order PQ. Now, well, we can put here coefficients, but you can, you know, absorb them to the definition of the momentum, so I won't put them here. So these kinds of things are called von Hoff singularities. In general, von Hoff singularity is a, you know, place where gradient of the energy function vanishes, but you could imagine that we could have some more complicated vanishing, but those won't occur in practice, basically, unless there's some symmetric reason for that. Like, you know, if you try to concoct something like this, say, in two dimensions, something of that sort, that's also von Hoff singularity, right? But how will we ever get that? You need to tune too many parameters. On the other hand, here, you need just to tune basically the Fermi level. So in other words, mathematically speaking, you have a function, generic function. Generic function is a Morse function, so all the critical points among the generics will be seen. So that's generic. Well, something like this, you need to tune the actual band structures. So, and I'll focus on the case with a two-dimensional case, that is two spatial dimensions, where just a dispersion will like that, plus dot dot, where is the high order term. Now, why two-dimensional case? Well, because if you look at the short-range interaction now in the system, that will turn out that it's the quantum coupling constant is dimensionless. It's a marginal coupling, it's perfect for applying a normalization group. If you look at three-dimensional case, the short-range interaction, like for Fermi interaction, particle physics speak, it's irrelevant. So the most interesting case is 2 plus 1 dimensional, two space, one time. Now let's start with the free theory and then add on this interaction. So the Lagrangian this. And you know, okay, let me just keep this. we keep this coefficients tx and ty, even though I can absorb them into the scaling of t's. Now that's the free action. Well, it's natural to consider a system with spins, so these guys have some sure indices. In the system, of course, since the energy is not positive definite, you have to fill out the states with negative energy with the particles, so you get the usual Fermi C. So, in this case, the Fermi C looks like, well, so the energy in these regions here, in these two quadrants, is positive, and this region is negative. The Fermi C has this cone-shaped form, and it's infinitely deep. So this is the place where it's singular, and it's the most interesting point, because here, all the usual considerations which apply to the generic point of the Fermi surface don't apply. Now, this first law can, of course, deviate from this simple quadratic form by higher terms, but we're going to look at the limit in the neighborhood of this point. In other words, we're going to scale the momentum to zero. So that limit can naively neglect with higher terms at the expense, perhaps, of renormalizing appropriately your marginal and relevant terms. Okay. Now, what are the symmetries of the system? Well, just look at the Lagrangian. So there is a U1 symmetry, which is multiplication of psi by phase, and then there is a spin symmetry. Then there is obvious sort of Lorentz symmetry, momentum space, all 1-1. Well, there could also, well, this another thing which is, well, also actually particle hole symmetry. In the system is exact particle hole symmetry. You replace psi by psi dagger, and also simultaneously, flip x and y, which changes the sign of the energy, then that's a symmetry. So it just exchanges. No, if you just replace psi by dagger, your Fermi C is going to be here rather than here. But then you flip x and y, it goes back to the symmetry. It's Z2 symmetry. Some Android probably reverses the sign of the electric charge. Now, actually, there's another symmetry. Well, there's, of course, translation invariance. That's actually that's what I want to say. This Galilean symmetry, if you look at the action, but the Fermi C breaks it down. Because the condition that energy is negative is not Galilean invariant. Actually, there's no Galilean symmetry in this problem. So not only it's not Lorentz invariant in the usual sense, it's not even Galilean invariant. It's just a translation invariant filter. But there is something which replaces Lorentz invariance, which is this all-in-one symmetry. It's accidental symmetry in the sense, because once you include the higher order terms, it's not there. But on the other hand, this accidental symmetry is really, this accidental symmetry is there for a reason, right? It's because it's there in the RG sense, like if you neglect everything. Right? So for example, if this symmetry is spontaneously broken, which could happen, if you neglect this higher order terms, you have a Goldstone boson. Well, if you do include them, this Goldstone boson will have a mass, it will be a very small mass if this guy is small. So the symmetry is important. Okay, so now let's end interactions to make life more interesting. But by the way, so it's kind of interesting kinematics, right? Because particles live in these wedges, and holes live in these wedges. So particles can only have propagate in this column and holes here. So in some sense, it's like an anode of chiral liquid or something like that. But it's not chiral. There's no left, right. So that's an interaction. In this case, there's not much room for interaction. If you want to have a zero-range interaction, there's a unique possibility. So you can rewrite in different ways, but yes?
I missed one point. I think in here you do a power counting of the momentum.
Yes.
In this problem, why momentum is small?
because there is scale momentum to zero. Sorry, why is it small? I started with some higher terms, and then just want to integrate out all states with high momentum, and just end up with effective field theory describing excitation.
It seems to me that Fermi surface.
Yes, that will lead to some peculiarities. Indeed, states with large momentum here might have low energy, right? Yes. So that's the interesting thing about this. So you can still integrate out high momentum excitations and end up with effective field theory, but it will have some interesting peculiarities because of this, because you're also integrating out some low energy states in the process.
Sorry, in your RG scheme, are you picturing integrating towards the Fermi surface or just integrating towards P equals
zero? I'm integrating towards P equals zero. So. Because you can't really integrate towards Fermi surface in this case, because typically integrate stuff normal to the Fermi surface, right? But there's no normal here, it's single. None of them are defined. The only option you have is integrating out towards zero. The other RG, well, if you have a small chemical potential, put that here. Another term. So for small nu, your Fermi surface is sort of like this, or maybe the other way around. But indeed, then at low energies, it's better to switch to another effective field theory, where integrate out stuff momentum perpendicular to the Fermi surface. However, when your energy scale, momentum scale is much larger than the chemical potential, you can work with this effective field theory. So as I lower the cutoff, at some point I have to switch to this scheme, because my original rescaling procedure, even though it's fine still, it won't be a good rescaling procedure. It's just like so that same massless QED, right? Oh, sorry, in massive QED, like when you're integrating out stuff, at some point you have to switch to a different vector field theory which takes into account that the electron is actually not massless. What's called non-relativistic QED. Similarly here, once you scale down to momentum scales of order of this distance between the Van Hove singularity and the Fermi surface, you have to switch to different effective field theory in order to avoid the large logarithms of the ratio of your subtraction, your scale and this distance. But until you run into this, you're fine with the system. Okay, so so this is the coupling, and it's marginal with respect to the scaling. And the question is, how does it run? So, yes?
So the coupling nu here, that's a relevant coupling.
That's a relevant coupling.
Are there other relevant couplings, or maybe you're coming to this?
So there are no other relevant couplings which, well, actually breaks this particle hole symmetry, of course. And there are no other couplings which you can forget about this one. There's nothing really which preserves this and is relevant. So that's the only coupling can write down. Or so it seems. Yeah.
So it's obvious here that the normalization group will work rescaling just space.
No, it's not obvious. It seems like a reasonable thing to do, but once I actually try to do that, and actually people did try to do that over the last 20 years, you do run into some problems you have to deal with. Okay. And I think we found a way to think about this, which is perfectly fine. And the point is that this model actually is not normalizable if you just keep this single coupling there, even though it seems like the only marginal coupling. So you have some divergences which you have to take care of, which you cannot take care of just simply by normalizing this field psi and this coupling.
But I mean, I could make the question more technical if I look at higher loops.
Yeah, well,
and I have these propagators which are very indefinite size. It's not as old to be sure the power counting gradients work those wrong. I mean, the fact that you have these singularities, in fact, is an indication that something is going wrong with them.
Not wrong, just questions how. Okay. So how do we normalize in this
scheme? Or at least requires further.
I'm just saying that in this case, if you're working exactly at zero chemical potential, for example, you don't have any other option. There's no other rescaling which makes sense in this case. There's no RG, the usual RG, which works in the case of smooth Fermi surface. You cannot rescale matter perpendicular to Fermi surface because that doesn't make sense.
So is it related question? So if I go and write down the sixth order or eighth order coupling, is that also what is its dimension?
So the dimension of the fields.
Is it relevant? Right.
Also the dimension of your px and py is 1. Dimension of derivative is 2. dimensional size 1, that's the only dimension, this is the only coupling I can write down. High order terms, since I have positive dimensions, are RG irrelevant for this regular scheme.
But that's the question, are they irrelevant?
Not if they produce singularities.
If you can renormalize this thing to all orders, then they are along the definition. Okay? Expressions can renormalize this thing, and and if you can't, how can you fix that? Actually, we'll see that this cannot be renormalized. You need to add some other terms. I think you need precisely one term. Actually, this model doesn't have one coupling, it has two couplings.
So you're going to need something to deal with this.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So what is the... Okay, let's try to see what sort of divergences here.
Before you go to RG, so you can just think about two-particle problem, let's say, particle in the hole in this problem, which attract each other. Would it have a bound state for this definition?
No, I don't think it will be a bound state. So this problem is a bit, when you try to do it, you're going to run up into actually the same regularization problems as you run into when you do this one-loop diagram. So it's not really a distinct problem.
Does that mean does the sign of G matter?
Yeah, we'll see that actually. Well, we'll get to that. Yeah.
You're leaving it open.
Yes. You want to solve
it? Try to deal with this problem by some kind of analytic configuration.
Not a good idea. Definitely not a good idea. No, it didn't even occur to us because it was obviously such a bad idea. And you'll see why, actually, in a second. So let's do it well with some one-loop diagram. So, if you look at just self-energy, that's not very interesting. Well, so I prefer to think in terms of form interaction, maybe some auxiliary field. So the diagrams look like in QED. Auxiliary field is a trivial propagator, so just a G. Propagator for the gradient. So matter of taste, it's easy to draw diagrams because you can see how all the indices are contracted right away. So if you look at, say, two-point Green's function, down into diagrams, and if you write them down, well, they're ill-defined, but they're not very important because they're actually the same diagram with different contraction of indices. And here it's very clear that it's going to be momentum independent. And this fellow, just a constant, which has to be the normalization of the chemical potential, which means it's in proportion to chemical potential, because it's by particle hole symmetry, you cannot generate something which is odd than the particle hole symmetry out of nothing. So if you're working at zero chemical potential, let me just work at zero for now. Then it's just defined to be zero. So don't we need to worry about that. Now, let's look at the four-point functions. So let's correspond to scattering of, say, two particles. So, so there are all kinds of them. So there are. Okay, this fellow. And similar guy with it. Line here, and then there is a box diagram. There's a cross box diagram, and there's a box diagram. So turns out that this diagram is special. This diagram is very special because it has two particles. An intermediate channel has two particles. So this one also looks like it has two particles. Actually, it's the artifact of the way I drew it. It actually has, this diagram has a particle hole in the intermediate channel, this one, especially obviously, also this one. And actually this one does too. So it's actually not that different from the first two. And if you do these diagrams, you know, do the loop integrals, you don't find anything particularly special. Well, the loop diagrams do diverge, and you have to regularize somehow. You can do either cut off a momentum space. So I don't put any cut off in energy, I just do the energy integral. But so cut off in momentum, well, can you just put a sharp cut off, or technically it's more convenient, as usual, to use dimensional regularization. So. Replace momentum space of dimension 1, 1, sort of 1 plus and 1 minus, to d plus 1 dimensional space with this signature. So d plus is in 1 minus, and let d to be this one.
No, but this formula is the opposite of the O and 1.
Yeah, well, we have O d 1, right? So okay. You do break particle hole symmetry. I could have used dd signature. Preserve particle hole, but it's not such a crucial symmetry. I can just remove it by hand by setting these diagrams to zero. So I don't really care. I could have done it. Technically, this is very convenient. Okay, so that's our regularization. If you do these three diagrams and the crossed version, you don't find anything special. They diverge, and so they are. Yeah, there's nothing. You get the usual simple poles.
Ultraviolet.
Yeah. Divergences are pure ultraviolet, and they you know, they appear as single poles. These guys have single poles in on our epsilon, so something like g squared times some number. Well, to be precise, you need to put some arbitrary subtraction point into the power epsilon as usual, and something like. Structure, the finite part does depend on, well, a complicated finite part. But the divergent part is just usual power counting works. You expect momentum independent expression because these guys are formulaically divergent, and you do get it. But this fellow is a bit strange. So, actually, computed using this scheme. You find based up to some spin factors, which I omit. Get this kind of divergence. It's also a finite part. But the important, the two related points here, but first of all, there's a double pole in epsilon. Not very common. And as a consequence of that, basically, also have a log of momentum. More precisely, this is the total incoming momentum. You want? Yes. Okay, so how do we deal with it? Well, as I said, you can rescale them away. I've done that already, yes. You can reinstate them if you want. Basically, what this does, if you rescale TX's, G gets rescaled to this. So, okay, so what do we do about this? So it's a divergent result, so I need to regularize it. Now, obviously, we need a counterterm. Well, we could kill this guy using a randomization of G, of course, but what do we do with this fellow? You need a counterterm which produces this. So what is this counterterm? Well, we need a counterterm which gives you log of this. So what is, well, and why did we miss it here, right? We did power counting, seems like we got everything we wanted. We wrote down the list of operators. Well, what we missed here is, one way to explain the following. It's a non-altruistic field theory. There's absolutely nothing wrong with operators in the action which are non-local in space, if they're local in time. So actually, every potential of non-zero range will have this non-locality in space. So once you take those into account, maybe we missed some operators, we should include them. Now, well, what sort of potential? Well, this was a delta function potential. So natural, well, dimension of delta function, two dimensions, is one or is minus two. So maybe you mean something like one over x squared potential, perhaps? No, we didn't miss it. The reason we didn't miss it, first of all, it's ill-defined, but you know, more importantly, this is not a T-channel interaction. This is a sum of net momentum flowing through the diagram. This is not a potential interaction. That will produce something like, maybe like log, I don't know, would involve Q1 minus Q1 prime, where Q1 prime is this total. This is the S-channel, so it's not a potential interaction which we're missing. And actually, thing like 1 over x squared in Minkowski space doesn't really have, it's not a really well-defined thing, like it doesn't have a well-defined Fourier transform. So what does have a well-defined Fourier transform is a bit, at least in this kind of signature. And by the way, this absolute value is kind of important. It's not like some p squared minus I epsilon, it's absolute value. What we missed is another one. Fine. So this is an action. So it's not local. Delta function of the square of special separation. So the index is, well, this x. So, if you do Fourier transform of this kernel in this signature, better be careful, since we're doing everything in this signature, you do get basically this. More precisely, find the Fourier transform.
That square inside the delta function is with respect to the indefinite signature?
So the square in the, yes.
Square inside the delta function,
yes.
You're taking that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Fourier transform of this turns out to be put this mu here, just it looks more like this. So in reality, you know, it's like this, if you expand it in powers of log mu, actually this will cancel this mu. So there's no mu here, of course, because it's a Fourier transform something which doesn't have any mu in it. So it just, I just wrote it so it's dimensionally looks like the same as this. So this is the guy which you need to cancel this log piece. We need to add this term to the action, some coefficient h. And then, more precisely, you know, as usual, in the normalized perturbation theory, some z factors here and there. And write zg and zh as a Laurent series in epsilon and require a cancellation. Then you find the z factors. By the way, there's no mu here.
H is
dimensionless in every dimension. This is clear because this guy has dimension minus 2 in every dimension. So it cancels extra integration. So it has dimension, well, has the right dimension in every dimension. Dimension. So. Okay, so we have two coupling problems, not one coupling problem. Okay, once it's realized, you can now...
Can I think of this in a slightly different way? So you're taking an RG scheme in which you're integrating out stuff which is far away from the origin, but very low in energy, right?
Yes.
Down to zero energy. So you might say, well, look, I'm integrating out lots of low energy stuff. I expect to generate long distance interactions. And what you're saying is
that you're generating a unique type of long distance interaction this way. You don't have to worry about generating all kinds of junk, just this one thing.
Yeah, the quantum is the only one you can generate. And you can make it clearer if you actually write it down a bit differently. Like maybe I find the following way of writing it more convenient. If you'll, let's me. So if I introduce light from coordinates, I can write it like this, and then that's a kernel. So it's sort of local, semi-local. It's local along x plus or x minus, but it's non-local in the direction of the light cone. So what this interaction does, well, we have two particles which come in, disappear, gets transported to light-like separated point with some amplitude, which slowly slowly decaying and go farther, and then reappear, right? So physically, it's clear why this happens. We're looking at this diagram, basically, right? So we have two particles which come in. And then the intermediate state might be that state with very high momentum and low energy, which we integrated out. What does it look like? Well, the two particles with moderate momentum came and got transported at very high velocity, very far, therefore. But only on the light cone, because the states to have low energy must be have light-like momentum. And then they again combined and they appeared with low normal momentum. That's what it looks like.
Sorry, did you write x greater than x squared plus x y.
Yeah, well, I guess it was bad notation. Maybe you should call it x prime here.
Okay, but that's the x combined. You're using positive metric. There's no.
No, this is indefinite metric. That's more, maybe more so x minus. I'm losing my notation is not very good, but this is the Minkowskian square. Okay. So this x plus and x minus are usual light cone coordinates in coordinates. Yes?
Is it clear that this is the only counterterm that would give you the right log p behavior to cancel?
Well, okay, so you can just write other distributions. They have to have this property of semi-locality, but it's physical handwriting argument. And that's the only one I can think of.
Okay.
P squared is the Euclidean.
No, this is again Minkowskian.
Absolute value. And down there, it's P1 plus P2 squared.
Again, sorry. With absolute value in the right place. Wrong place. So it's
that's Minkowski again?
Minkowski, but absolute value.
So to answer his question, you just before you transform what you had in minus space, you get what you got.
Yes, but I'm saying that maybe at high orders, you generate some other non-local divergence.
Yeah.
So in principle, you have to say, okay, first of all, what do I expect? But this we don't have a proof, but this naive argument says that you should only expect distributions which are like non-vanishing only along the light cone, and only have this particular dimension. Okay. And I think that's the only one you couldn't have. So,
well, what happens when you stick that into the diagram?
You do get logarithmic divergences. Yeah, well, we did run some diagrams with that interaction. We did some diagrams with it. Well, it doesn't change. The divergence comes from kinematic structure of this Van't Hoff singularity. So I think this mild logarithmic singularity momentum space doesn't spoil anything. So you still have the same divergence structure. We didn't check it at higher loop order.
Might get double
locked. As I say, I don't think you can, but we don't have a proof.
You can't because
it wouldn't have a good Fourier transform. It wouldn't have this property that in X space it's a semi-local distribution which is non-vanishing along the light cone.
If Fourier transform would double lock, you'll get something in the same dimension.
Yeah, but it won't have this property in the in coordinate space. It's non-vanishing only along the light cone. I'm not sure it's well defined actually, but it won't be that for sure, okay? distributions in X space are just delta functions and derivatives. And that's the only reasonable distribution which has the only distribution which has always locality properties is delta function.
Can I think about this fourth interaction in the momentum space? Is this basically P minus P to P prime minus P prime along the Fermi surface?
No, that's the momentum space interaction. Like, it's a scattering amplitude of this form. So we should like this. The same thing. This bit. Yes?
Should you a Cooper or ladder? Is it the only singularity in theory? So is it the only ladder which gives you a solution of logs? So what happens if you have just a particle hole?
You don't have the singularity. Like in this, yeah, for example, this channel or here in this loop, you don't have.
Okay, this is particle hole.
It's only in the particle-particle channel have this funny kinematics.
But you have single blocks in those.
Right?
In those channels, you have single blocks.
What do you mean? They mean single poles and epsilon.
Maybe just physically.
And divergences are single logs of the cutoff, if you want. And here are double logs of the cutoff. Okay. So at one loop, at least, you can remove all divergences just by using this single counter term. So now you can derive the RG equation for these two coupling constants in the usual way by requiring the bare couplings to be independent of mu. And what do you find? Well, we find the following. I'm using system equations. That the RG time be log mu. Now, we don't have terms here order, principle that terms order h squared or hg, and same here, if you haven't computed. But formally, these are of high order, and the reason they're high order is because, but yeah, G is the my delta function interaction, and H is this Newton local interaction.
Light cone interaction.
Yes, light cone interaction. Well, say it this way. So H is induced only at one loop order. Okay. So you should say that H is sublimiting. H is much smaller than G. So for example, all these terms therefore are sublimiting compared to those I kept. So that's why I dropped them. Well. Actually, the coefficient here is not terribly important, because if once you assume this, you can change your scheme to get rid of this fellow. Well, only modifying terms here. You can basically just say, well, you can just redefine your g by g plus h times something number. That's a high-order correction, just a change of scheme. And using this freedom, you can just kill this term here. It's just a convenient device to solve the equation. Suppose we did that. In the MS scheme, you just have these equations. But in the there's a better scheme which gets rid of this. Drop that. So you get a very simple system of equations, right? So something can give to a first year undergraduate. Hopefully can solve it. She can solve it. Well, actually, it took me some time to solve it. I did try to do it on my own, but then I realized Mathematica is the way to go. And it turns out that if you want a general solution, it will be an expression of inverse some hypergeometric functions with parameters like 1/3 and 2/3. So I don't know if that can be done in terms of any normal function I've ever seen, but okay, you don't need that. You can just write everything in terms of some integrals. But the thing which I can do myself without Mathematica is to find the flow lines for this RG equation. So neglecting this higher order terms is just this. So in the AHG plane, the lines are given by this equation. Let me sketch this equation. So I chose normalization so that positive g corresponds to repulsion and negative g to attraction, so the standard. Well, there's a special trajectory corresponding to kappa, the prime equal to zero. So that's a sort of cuspidal curve. And then there are flow lines which go below it. Above it. Symmetric, of course, because h going to minor changes the symmetry, of course. That's what the flow looks like. So the picture is symmetric and the h goes to minus h and changing the direction of RG time. What does this theory do? Well, first of all, it doesn't matter where you start from. Well, typically start from h equals zero, because originally at some cutoff, you don't have any h coupling, just the local coupling. Somewhere here, or maybe here. And then as you flow towards IR, this is the flow towards IR, so it's minus tau. This is the direction of decreasing tau. As you flow towards IR, you actually flow with to strong coupling. And in finite RG time, you run off to infinity. So at least if you believe these equations. Of course, once you run off to strong coupling, you can't really trust them. But anyway, so at finite, formally to solve them at finite RG time, your couplings blow up.
You always end up in the attraction, yeah?
And you always end up also in the attractive regime, yes. So no matter if you start with repulsive, you still end up with attractive. Yeah, I think it's very interesting. So you sort of generate attraction simply by renormalizing your short-range interaction, which might be repulsive. By the way, so that the problem has two couplings. So there are two parameters, both in the quantum and classical theory. So in the quantum theory, you can take as one of the parameters that strongly coupled scale where everything blows up. And you can also take another parameter could be, for example, either the value of this coupling G right here, basically the same parameter as kappa, right? H is zero, that's kappa. Or you can take the ratio of two scales, your strongly coupled scale and the scale where you cross this line, h equals zero. We actually numerically solve for this. The ratio between these two guys is huge, actually, but just by accident. For this IR UV coupling and IR coupling, then with numerical accident. The log of these two scales is huge. I mean, if kappa is not like even too small. If it's small, of course, it's of course very large. But even if it's not too small, because of this 8, you get a huge hierarchy of scales between the UV, where you start out, and where H vanishes, and the IR, where finally everything blows up in your face. So in reality, it means you'll probably, if in any physical situation, probably never get to that point. Some other effect will cut off the running of the coupling. For example, that chemical potential, which I so far neglected. So, if you want, as I say, the general solution of the couplings is complicated, but with a special RG trajectory, which starts from zero. Let's say, so the general RG trajectory runs off to strong coupling both in the IR and in the UV. So the theory is not as particularly free, but there's a special trajectory, or rather pair trajectory. Once we start from zero coupling in the in the UV and run also strong coupling that's asymptotically free, you end the other one, the opposite where.
Naively, once you start discussing that region, I don't see why you could reject the H squared terms in the HGT.
I'm saying that just, yes, really it's only neighborhood. I blew up sort of the neighborhood right in this HG space.
Yeah, but H is getting much bigger than G, so why are the H squared terms?
No, it's not getting much bigger than G. H is, in this trajectory, H is G to the power 3 halves. So it's actually smaller than G parameter. What do you mean, when G is large, really large?
The picture doesn't look like the way it's drawn.
Maybe it's like, okay, like this one. Yeah, it's like this somehow. Oh, wait. No, it's not true. That's correct. That goes correct, like this. Yeah, it's like this. And near the origin, H is the order. Yes, that's why it's like this. So, well, for example, the exact form of the trajectory, for example, looks like this. So. G goes like 1 over log squared. H goes like 1 over log cube. Okay. So this applies, of course, only for small g and h. Once they become large, I can't really say anything. That's perturbative analysis. Okay. Now, okay, so that's an interesting behavior which says that the model actually, no matter whether it's with attraction or repulsion, you always at low enough momentum, you end up with an attractive interaction, and therefore, presumably, there's some instability. Okay. The instability, which presumably results in some sort of superconducting ground state. Now, what it actually looks like, maybe I'll address a bit later, I don't really know, but let me just say a few words about it towards the end. But let me just say that there are interesting modification of this in the case when, say, you have an actual systems where there's one whole singularity, sometimes they occur in pairs. For example, you have like an electron hopping on a lattice. With just next, with the nearest neighbor hopping, then at half filling you have this one-hole singularity on the Hubbard model, and but there are two one-hole singularities. So there's a point in momentum space, 0 pi, and there's a point pi 0. They both have one-hole singularity, and they degenerate in energy. So if you decided you have both, in other words, you have two flavors of this electron. Now, you sort of can formally shift them, put on top of each other, just say you have a single and whole singularity, with two flavor electrons with some interactions. And once you include interactions, well, for a single flavor, there's only one interaction with this single coupling G, even at leading order. We have several and whole singularities, there are more possibilities, just because of different ways of, well, there's now U1 cross U2 cross U2 symmetry, but only the diagonal subgroup must be preserved. So there's all kinds of contractions you can write down. And we have several G couplings, you can wonder, well, what about the normalization? I'm going to have several of these H guys. Now, turns out that if you do the same one loop analysis, that only happens if your two light cones in momentum space for the two one-hole singularities are exactly the same. It's called a nested one-hole singularities. In general, there's no symmetry reason for this to happen. So the fact that energy is the same for the two one-hole point might be imposed by some symmetry, like rotation, say, of x and y directions, like here. But that does not ensure that the cones have the same angle. You can check that. It's not obvious, but. And then if they do have different angle, then there's no there's no divergence, as we kind of described, in local and local one. in this box diagram when one particle here is of one kind, another one from a different Van Hove singularities. These double logs only occur when the electrons are exactly aligned for particles 1 and 2. That's again because kinematics simply doesn't allow them. You have two different light cones. Ask, is it possible to have huge momentum and low energy? That's only possible if light cones are on top of each other. Okay. So as a result, the beta function is going to be rather different in that unnested case, which is natural. So that is, there will be some logs. Well, the beta function will involve logs of this angle between the two light cones. And only if the angle is zero, then it gets this double divergence, which you can sort of reduce everything back to the original case. So we haven't finished the analysis of that, but what basically means is presumably a large enough angle between the two light cones, this instability towards BCS condensation is the only one, and other instabilities like spin density waves, charge density, don't occur. You need to have this nesting, or just one Van Hove to, you need to have a nesting in order to have this, or something close to nesting if you want to have the other instabilities.
Okay. Sorry, can you say a little bit more about why these cones should be different, say, for like the square lattice Hubbard model? Where
well, because when you use XY, sort of the symmetry, what happens is that the cone is, well, you need to flip, you do some particle hole transformation to, before you sort of...
Why can't you just rotate?
They won't, it will become, well, what happens if the angle of the cone is 45 degrees, then the white cones are the same. But if they're not 45, now they're different. The two, after this transformation, they're different. So, and so you're going to have a diagonal hopping that will cause such an effect. And in general, so tetragonal symmetry doesn't require this angle to be 45 degrees because tetragonal symmetry relates two different light cones, doesn't tell you the angle of 45 degrees should be exactly for a particular light cone. So as a result, generically, you don't get this the same angle after you do this transformation, after you sort of map this point to that point.
You will get pi minus that angle. So you will get pi minus that. I mean, this if you have to charge one, so it's not enough that you just have rotated.
Yeah, right. This symmetry relates to different points. It doesn't really help.
I have another question. So there are other instabilities which amount to transferring particles between the two flavors in your language, which is essentially breaking the tetragonal symmetry. It's called pneumatic instability, and that has a logarithmic susceptibility. So I think there's another channel. There's another interaction. There's a flavor mixing interaction.
No, the flavor mixing I included already in this into this particle. Well, when you have two interactions, it's kind of a sort of short-range interaction, which mixes the flavors. But if the light cones are different, I think, I didn't compute the beta functions for this case, but I think if the opening angle is large enough, so you can show that between the two light cones, if they're not, then I think it's probably going to happen that the going to be driven to won't appear. You need to have a close enough light cones in order for this to happen. In general, there are all kinds of instabilities. Yes. Well, let me just finish by saying the following thing. So far I just addressed the issue of renormalizing this theory, which is an perturbative regime, so which means that if you can really renormalize it, and I argue that you can, that means that at least at high enough energies, suppose you started not from very large coupling, at higher energies you're still close to this small coupling, and your trilateral results just get logarithmic corrections. So which means that result estimates based on free field theory of this one-hole singularity, just neglecting this interaction terms altogether, should be logarithmically correct up to logarithmic estimates. So, for example, things like a marginal thermoliquid behavior, which just basically behavior of the one loop diagram, should be stable with respect to this high order radiative corrections for the Van Hove singularity. Now, a much harder question, though, is what is the ground state of this whole thing? Is it stability towards BCS sort of ground state? But that cannot be the whole story for the following simple reason. So let's ask, what sort of symmetry could the condensate break? So BCS condensate breaks, well, so we have, what is the symmetry we have? The case of a single Van Hove singularity. So I will drop the particle hole symmetry because it's not important for them, I'm going to say. And anyway, it's broken by any chemical potential. So you would, well, BCS ground state, the usual one, would just break this one. There are single Goldstone boson. Now, but I think that this actually cannot happen. Any ground state should break this one, or perhaps also translational symmetry. Well, if it breaks translational symmetry, if the quantum breaks translational symmetry, it probably breaks this one too, because, for group theory reasons. But you can imagine a situation maybe where this it breaks, this doesn't, sort of pneumatic state of some sort. So this is basically a point symmetry in this for this one whole singularity. But why did I say that it cannot just break the usual BCS symmetry, the charge symmetry? Well, you could just ask yourself, well, what is the Lorentz effective action? What does it look like for this Goldstone boson? And if you don't break 011, then your effective action must have this 011 symmetry, which acts purely on the coordinates. So a single Goldstone boson use light cone coordinates, more convenient. Use light cone coordinates, x plus and x minus. You can write something like this, and the quadratic term derivatives will have to go this form because of, well, under 011 symmetry is basically the one which acts x plus and x minus like this. So to have something invariant, you've got to have a kinetic term like that. But that's not positive definite, right? So in the y direction, x plus minus is x plus minus y. In y direction, you're going to have negative energies if you give a gradient to phi. That's clearly unstable with respect to the breaking of translational symmetry. Now it doesn't. You can say, well, maybe by accident, even though I can't imagine such an accident. Maybe by accident, this coefficient vanishes, right? Maybe we need to go to like quartic term or something like that. Well, it doesn't help, because that's not much better. It is positive semi-definite, but it's not positive definite. Hence that giving a light-like gradient to this fellow doesn't cause any energy. So it's sort of neutrally unstable with respect to breaking of translational symmetry. So if you therefore if you break U1 symmetry, you have to break also translational symmetry and consequently also rotational symmetries. It's all 1-1. Or alternatively, you could just break maybe this one and this one. You can repeat the analysis for the case of two Goldstone bosons, one for the U1, one for the 011. The action still has an 011 symmetry, but non-linearly realized. And you can check that depending on the value of the coefficients, the action for two Goldstone bosons is stable. So for some range of coefficients, it will be fine. So a sort of pneumatic electronic pneumatic ground state for the system is also a possibility. I don't know which possibility is actually realized. So it'll be very interesting to find out. And I'll stop here.
You can't write down a operator that just breaks 011?
Yeah, write an operator. Well, I still have a hands exhibit in repeating sort of BCS analysis for the system and reproducing this symmetry analysis, that is what sort of contents that would solve sort of the gap equations or whatever and break either 011 or 011 and translational symmetry. So far we haven't succeeded in doing that.
You haven't found.
We haven't, but it has to be, well.
Yeah.
Yes?
Is the situation rendered that you have because then you have a contribution.
That's true. When you have two one-fourth points, you no longer have. In the unnested case, you don't have this problem. That is, you don't have one-one symmetry, even though I think in some cases the coupling between two different one-fourth singularities for some range of angle tension flow to zero, and then you end up with the same problem, basically. So.
You think you get two decoupled?
Yes. I think for some value of the opening angles, you can actually may probably show that they decouple. I haven't checked that.